the CRP thing, I think very good. A lot of people pushing for that. CRPO is popular with landowners, environmentalists, conservationists, all of the above, people that are supporting hunting and that type of thing. And the acres are set to expand from the current 24 million cap to 27. It'll be phased in over the five-year farm bill. And 2 million of those acres will be set aside for grasslands. And like you said, they did change that rate, 85% for general and 90% for the other. Another program in conservation that was maintained as the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP, that was set to be cut out in the House Farm Bill, and it was in the Senate, and they did cut back the funding, but they kept the program. And that's a fairly popular program in states like Minnesota and the Dakotas, and so that's probably good news. And they also expanded the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP, which, again, has been used by a lot, especially livestock producers, to upgrade facilities and purchase equipment that's more environmentally friendly. And that's a great program for dairy and hog producers and others, as well as crop farmers been able to use that, too. Commodity program, you mentioned the choice. I think just the fact that they got the farm bill done and we weren't stuck with keeping the program we had was a positive, because obviously for farmers, at least for corn and wheat, to be able to switch to the PLC program for 19 instead of staying in our county will probably could potentially have some benefits, I guess, for payments. And another positive, I think, especially in some areas, will be in probably counties like McLeod, Meeker, some of the counties that had some low yields back when we updated yields last time. You can now use 2013 to 17 yields, 81% of those yield averages for corn and soybeans. And if that's higher than your previous FSA yield, you can update your yields, which are used for the PLC payments. So that could be a positive. They kept the payment limits the same at $125 per individual and the $900,000 adjusted gross income. Now, one thing they did do, because of some of the structures we have in farm families now, they now allow nieces, nephews, that type of thing, to count toward payment limits where they didn't before. They were a little more strict. So cousins, nephews, nieces, might be able to qualify. They still have, if it's a niece or nephew that lives in Washington, D.C., and they come home twice a year, they probably still won't qualify, because they still got to meet the actively engaged in farming requirements through FSA. The other good piece, I think, for farmers is they didn't make any big changes to crop insurance, just some minor tweaks. So the core program for crop insurance, which is kind of a cornerstone of risk management for most crop producers, will stay the same. And the last one I want to mention is they did do some nice upgrades to the dairy program, now called the Dairy Margin Coverage Program, or DMC. And most of those upgrades were for under 5 million pounds of production per year, which would kind of equivalates to about 200 to 250 cow herds. So that'll help some of our small to medium-sized herds.
One other thing I want to mention is that I think is an improvement. I know for us in Lincoln County, we've had some issues over this. They are not going to use NAS statistics anymore for the county yield. They're actually going to be using the RMA numbers, which is really the best way to do it, because there are actually two numbers. Because we have to tell our crop insurance, we have to show production. We have to show exactly what we produced on our farms. So they will have used true numbers before, when the National Agriculture Statistics Service, they would just call between 20 and 30 farmers in the county and ask them what their yields were. So, I mean, a farmer could not have his yield monitor, you know, programmed and just guess, or else if he wanted to play the system, they could go high, could go low. I mean, they could say anything they wanted to. This is really a true way for the government and for the farmers.
One thing that I'd like to...
Yeah, one more thing on that, Bob. I was going to say they're also basing the payments for Arc County on where the farm is located. In the last farm bill, the payments were based on whatever the producer declared as their administrative county. So if they had land in four counties, they could claim one county as their administrative county. And if that county happened to have high payments, they could get payments on all their land. And it was really creating some unfair advantages and affecting rental rates and that type of stuff. So this was certainly a good change, again, to base it on where the land's located, not on what decision the farmer made to do his FSA business.
And I just wanted to follow up on something that Kent talked about, covering the farm bill here for the entire year. He mentioned that we're fortunate that the bill got done before the end of the year, and it really did come down to the wire in December. First, you had out of the four principal leaders of the House and Senate Ag Committees, you know, three were kind of on the same page, and then there was one outlier. And for a long time, that was Conaway, the House chairman. But towards the end, it became Debbie Stabenow, who wanted to get some forestry changes included in the farm bill. Then you had the passing of President Bush, and that delayed getting a vote on the farm bill. There was another issue that came up, and it nearly ended up being the week of the government shutdown, with that kind of staring the leaders in the face, that they had to get this farm bill passed by the House, Senate, and then to the president's desk, because once that shutdown came, we're probably looking at a new Congress dealing with the farm bill, and who knows how long it would take to get it done. So talking to Colin Peterson last week, he called it a miracle that it got done this year.
I think Colin was a real fighter for this bill, wasn't he?
He really was, and I know he's really proud of the changes they made to dairy, like Kent talked about, some improvements there, especially for the smaller and medium-sized dairies.
From day one. He's fought for the dairy day one. He's really been a true leader for the dairy industry, and I'm glad he got some changes done.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Congressman Peterson is probably, you know, in this day of partisan politics, he's probably one of the remaining members of Congress that truly does represent his district and fight for the things that are important out there, and he continues to do that, and he'll now be in a leadership role on the House Ag Committee, so that's certainly, I don't think, a bad thing for farmers in the upper Midwest. There's one other farm bill note that I wanted to mention that doesn't relate to commodity programs or conservation, and that's the farm credit title, and this is important to ag lenders, but also to a lot of farmers that use FSA loans, guaranteed loans or direct loans. They increased the beginning farmer, or they lowered the requirement, I guess, for beginning farmers, or they increased the amount they can borrow. Excuse me, I'm getting mixed up here. They increased the amount they can borrow up to $600,000 if they're buying land for a farm ownership loan from $300,000. Of course, $300,000 didn't go very far. And those are long-term, low-interest loans, so it's really beneficial to beginning farmers. And then the other thing that they did was they increased the total amount that a farmer can have on guaranteed loans. It used to be $700,000 per borrower. Of course, farms have gotten bigger and more, and they need more credit nowadays. They increased that to $1.75 million, so they more than doubled it. So those are both very positive, I think, both for farm operators that use those programs and for ag lenders. It gives them another tool in the toolbox to work with farmers.
You know, with all the problems they got in the federal government, this is almost a miracle to get this farm bill passed, isn't it?
It is, because, you know, the Senate, for once, was the leader, and they got their version of it passed, and it took the House a lot longer. And then I didn't think the conferees were ever going to get together on a bill. I mean, we had this the Senate version done in July. I mean, that's unheard of to have that done that early. And usually the Senate is always the one that's dragging their feet. But boy, they were the leader on this, and I can really thank our two senators from Minnesota to be to be the leaders on that to get it done.
I would have to say, you know, we certainly gave a lot of credit to Congressman Peterson, and deservedly so, on kind of weaving his way through this system and kind of staying in the game, even though the House ended up being quite partisan. But, you know, I think the Senate in general, certainly our two senators were part of that, but was bipartisan on this farm bill all the way through. I mean, both times they had over 85 votes to pass it. And, you know, I think a lot of credit there goes to Senators Roberts and Stabenow, one Republican, one Democrat, that steered this thing through and kept their support together. I mean, these two kind of went above the partisan politics and did what was good for the good of the whole. And really, the final bill resembles more of the Senate bill than it does the House bill. So.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since a new farm bill was passed in the same year that the previous one expired.
Yeah, it's been forever. I don't remember the last
time. Yeah, that hasn't happened very often, Bob, right, in our memory.
We've always had at least one extension, maybe two. You know, it's just unreal. This is good. And I'll go back to what you said, Kent. This was really a bipartisan bill, and it doesn't happen very often in the Senate. I mean, you see a little more. You used to see it more in the House, but boy, this Senate this time really was the leader in it. It was really quite impressive that the Senate did this for a farm bill. And I think we got I think it's something we're going to like.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad in this. You know, some of the big time cable news networks, all they want to talk about is the partisan politics, and very little was made nationally about this farm bill being passed outside of the normal ag circles and in rural areas. But it is pretty, it does point that there is hope, I think, out there. Sometimes people figure there's no hope anymore when we talk about the federal government, but it does point out that they still can get things done if they kind of all have the same target they're shooting for.
Well, I think when we all go to bed tonight, we better thank God way this farm bill turned out, and it's the rapidness of it, and there's just so many blessings there.
If we would not have had this farm bill, it would have been very difficult for bankers, any lenders, to move forward with new operating monies in the 2019. It would be very difficult because the uncertainty of not knowing where anything is would be just mind-boggling. And I know the banker I work with was very, very pleased that the farm bill was passed. At least he had something he could put on paper.
Well,
yeah, I would agree with that, Bob, that certainty with the farm bill, at least, you know, not just for 19, but really beyond as you look down. And the other, you know, big factor that happened late in the year besides the farm bill was when the president tweeted that the second market facilitation program payment would be made as scheduled, because that had a lot of farmers and ag lenders worried that if we didn't get that second payment, there were some people going to be in a world of hurt, especially in the upper Midwest.
That is true now. I mean, it will be coming out, won't it, the monies?
I had a farmer come in this morning that his got deposited today into his bank account from the FSA office. So if you were previously signed up, those payments are likely to come in yet this year, and you already had gotten your first payment. If you hadn't signed up yet, you probably won't get the payments now till after the first of the year. Most likely. Now, what I've heard, I guess, through the something put out through Minnesota Soybean Association by the American Soybean Association, I'm sure Bob saw this too, is that sounds like the FSA offices will be open through tomorrow, but after that, they'll probably be furloughed until this government shutdown gets solved.
Yep. Well, I tell you, I think we can just be thankful that this farm thing went through, because we all get hungry, we all like to eat. And when you start slamming the farmers, you're probably slamming most of the United States for whatever purpose or whatever reason. It's just too bad. Mark Dornkamp, are you there?
You betcha, Lester. Merry Christmas.
Yes, sir, you too. What do you hear? You go throughout the state all over. What do you hear about this bill? Are the people happy about that farm bill, or
Yeah, I'd echo what both Bob and Kent said as far as, you know, not a lot of drastic changes to the commodity title, but some tweaks, some improvements. And getting back to the market facilitation program payments, there was, you know, I talked about it earlier with the Farm Bill and how it came down to the wire. There were a lot of people questioning whether the Trump administration would sign off on the second round. There was speculation that Trump was waiting to see if this trade truce with China was going to lead to some major purchases. And if so, maybe that second payment wasn't going to be necessary. The Office of Management and Budget apparently was really scrutinizing the numbers and made it difficult for that stamp of approval to make the second round of payments. But, you know, one of the things to remind people of for farmers out there is that you still have time. Even if you missed the first round, you only have to sign up once for both payments. And I believe the deadline is January 15th. I saw an FSA official say today that they don't think they're going to extend that deadline, even with the government shutdown. So January 15th is really that key date. And since FSA offices are open right now, I would not waste any time if you haven't signed up for those payments yet. You know, there's the payment for soybeans, payment for pork. I know the corn farmers were pretty disappointed that they didn't do anything with round two here to improve on that penny a bushel. But, you know, something's better than nothing, I guess. But, again, I think January 15th is the deadline to sign up for those.
And
yeah, Mark, you're right.
If you want the money, go ahead, Kent. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Bob. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Well, all I want to say is if you don't want the money this year, go up and sign the form. Get the application in. You don't have to give them production until May 1st. You have to have the production into the FSA office by May 1st. So everybody's got to go in and get the application signed.
Yeah, I was going to follow up with that. You have till May 1st, so there's no reason not to sign up now. And you don't even have to go into the FSA office. You can actually go online, and the form is right there, and fill it out. But I would say get that done and yet today or tomorrow, and make sure it's in the hopper at least, so you got yourself covered in case the government shut down. They might shut the website down too or something. So I would get that done, and then if you want to wait till next year to be sure you get the payment, wait till after the first of the year to submit your production data, but at least get the application on the books.
Kent, you're in the finance department. Are there any certain deadlines other than this January 15th of things that have to be signed?
You know, not really. I think the government shutdown, you know, obviously these payments get a lot of attention. The other thing that could kind of come up to affect farmers, a lot of farmers like to use the CCC, Commodity Credit Corporation, loans on their grain to get some cash right after the first of the year to pay some bills, either end-of-the-year bills from last year or prepaid expenses on some money. So that could affect some farmers not having access to that money. I guess the best thing you can do there, talk to the FSA office, find out what they're looking at as far as procedures or being able to access that money, and then work with your ag lender. If the ag lender knows the money's coming, most of them will probably work with the producer on a short-term loan till that money comes in.
I think we had a very good discussion as far as the Farm Bill. I mean, many things that I didn't know about that I heard from you guys, and it was really good to hear, and I'm not a farmer, but I sure endorse farming, and it was good to hear that. Let's go to another topic. Where are we standing with the trade for Mexico, Canada, and China? Where are we at with all the commodities and the tariffs and all of that?
You can take this, Mark.
Sure, I'll get us started anyway. Boy, there's a lot to talk about, Lester.
Yep.
I'll start, I guess, with Mexico and Canada, the new U.S. Mexico-Canada agreement, which replaces NAFTA. The leaders of all three countries have signed on to the agreement. However, the steel and aluminum tariffs are still in place, and I talked to somebody a couple of weeks ago about that, and their suggestion was that President Trump wants to have those tariffs for leverage. He's going to have to work with Congress, the new Congress, which isn't going to be so heavily Republican, to get this trade deal through. And so we still see those steel and aluminum tariffs out there. I talked to Steve Sukup with Sukup Manufacturing. They're a leading grain bin and grain handling manufacturer located in northern Iowa. And he said that the tariffs have raised the cost of steel, and they only use American steel 30% since they were imposed. So it's really impacting their bottom line, which in turn is impacting the bottom line of farmers, which storage this year especially, a lot of the corn and soybeans went into the bin out of the field this fall. So something to think about there. But again, the deal has been agreed to by the leaders of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, but that's a long way from the finish line.
Yeah. Bob, you do a lot of, or used to go to China and so forth, and you're still on the state board of the soybeans. Where are we standing with sales right now with soybeans to China?
They're very poor. I mean, we are starting to make sales to China. It's very, very slow, extremely slow. I mean, it's one of those things, Lester, that am I really, you know, unhappy with the tariffs? Yes. But do I think it had to be done? Something had to be done to correct the balance of trade. Mm-hmm. We understand that. Mm-hmm. But it's sad that, you know, that we spent years and years working, building a relationship with China so they understood our product. They were using a lot of our product. You know what? But I just hope we don't lose that, Lester. I hope we don't lose that, and they will come back to us.
Are they going to crawl over to South America and buy soybeans? Or?
Oh, yeah, they are. I mean, they are. But, you know, they're limited there. There's only so many beans that they can have. The soybeans are very unique. There's only so many beans in the world.
Yep.
And China takes a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can't get them all from South America, they have to go someplace, and it's the United States. Yeah. And if China takes all the beans from South America, well, guess what? The other countries have to come to us and buy beans. And that's what's happening. We are selling beans to foreign countries that we have never sold to before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, you know, we are not selling the beans that we need to sell because we raise such a huge crop.
Yeah.
But we are selling a lot of beans out of the United States. I mean, we got beans going to the European Union, which it hasn't done for many years.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of beans going to countries that have never bought beans from the United States. Are they just buying the beans and then shipping them on to China? We don't know. But some of the countries are actually buying beans and starting to use the beans like we did for China many years ago. Now, these people are starting to use beans and starting to realize that beans are good feed for their livestock and everything. So that's a very big plus. That's a plus that I can see coming out of this. There's a lot of negatives, but this is a very big plus that will help us in the long run. If we can ever get back to, we have China and everybody on board again, it's going to be a really interesting market because it'll really be, people are really going to want to buy beans.
And aren't the Chinese pretty fussy about quality of beans? And I think U.S. has probably got some of the best quality soybeans, right?
Well, I know they got the best quality compared to South American or a lot of other countries. But China also likes to do with dollars and cents. They want to buy as cheap as they can possibly get them so they can make the most money. And that's what they do. You know, their livestock producers over there, they raise a lot of chickens and a lot of pork. So there is they need a lot of soybean meal and a lot of, and they're actually using the oil for biodiesel and et cetera over in China also. So.
What Canada and Mexico and our dealings with them?
You know,
well,
I
with Canada. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say with Canada and Mexico, you know, the tariffs on the ag products are still in place there. It was talked about earlier about the steel and how it's affecting people here that are our manufacturers here, but those tariffs are still in place. And again, Canada and Mexico are our big trading partners. Between the three countries, Canada, Mexico, and China, they count for about half of the ag exports for the United States. So it's a big factor. In fact, as you were talking about the impact it's had in China, the soybean sales for the year, this was through November, were down
almost 40%. And of course, most of those sales occurred in the first half of the year. Now, we did get some recent ones, probably helped improve those numbers a little bit. But at the same time, Brazil's sales of soybeans to China were up by 25%. So that kind of shows kind of what's happened here with that trade. But, the big thing here is we have a big surplus. If we just talk soybeans, we have a huge, not only U.S., but world surplus of soybeans right now. So even if things started to improve, for us to see an immediate impact, obviously there'd be some positives that might bring the market up a little bit, but you know, as you look out for 2019, maybe into 20, it's going to take a while to kind of get the system back on track, like Bob was talking about. And Bob also talked about the fact that these trade agreements with countries get put together over many years. People like Bob and others with the Soybean Association nationally spent a lot of time with China, and people have with other countries to build these up. And you know, a lot of trade agreements comes down to one word, trust. And you got to trust the partners you're trading with. And once that you break that trust, it takes a while to get it back. So, you know, there's no guarantee in some of these countries. They're probably going to hedge their risk a little bit, and they're going to say, well, I don't know if we want to depend on one country quite that much anymore. We're going to spread our risk around a little. So I think there's, you know, it's probably not, we'd like to think there'd be a short-term solution here, that we're going to go back to the way it was, but it's probably going to take some time. And, you know, I think back to Farm Bill, there was some money put in there again for trade promotion and that type of thing. And at the same time, we're talking about China, Canada, Mexico, we need to be looking at other countries and trying to broaden our base on where we're shipping our ag products to as well. And again, that's challenging because we chose not to be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and some of these other multilateral trade agreements. So we're just, the approach that the Trump administration has taken is bilateral agreements one by one with countries, mm-hmm. and that takes a lot more time and effort to try and build those up. Not that it's all bad, it might turn out good, but it doesn't happen real quickly on those type of deals.
Not overnight. Mark, what do you hear about the insurances, health insurances for farmers throughout the state?
Well, it's still a major concern, and I don't know, and Bob and Kent would be probably more, well, certainly would be more informed on this than I am, but as far as, you know, relief from some of those escalating costs, I don't know that there's been anything introduced this year that has helped to offset some of those costs. And when you look at the farmer's bottom line, you have to figure in cost of living. And farmers are paring back in every single category, and when their health care costs continue to go higher and higher, boy, that puts a lot of pressure on the family. And again, Bob and Kent both could certainly speak to that.
You know, I'm going to say something just quickly. You know, I got a son and wife and family farming with us, and you know, he's in his middle 40s, and they're paying, you know, $40,000 for health care, and that's include their premiums and their deductible. And you take that off of your family living. I mean, or add that to your family living. My goodness, with the depressed pricing and everything, there is no money in agriculture right now when you start talking health care and everything put together. Something's got to be done. That's your biggest cost in family living right now is your health care, and you have to have health care. I mean, when you go to the hospital or something, it doesn't take long to eat up a quarter of land.
No, they
you know that
you even pay for gauze when you go to the hospital.
Yeah,
yeah. I was going to say, Lester, Bob brings up a good point. You know, a lot of times we see comparisons of what average family living costs are for farm families compared to other families that probably at least one of the spouses working at a job where they have benefits and they that includes health and insurance coverage and that type of thing. And it's really like comparing apples to oranges, because Health insurance costs make up such a big part of that family living cost for farm families where they don't have one of the spouses that has that kind of benefit. So it is a, it's a huge thing. You know, I think there's some programs now that some of the co-ops have done to try and ease the pain, but we got a long ways to go. And it isn't just getting the insurance coverage, it's access to health care. They've put so many restrictions on access, and it really hits hard in rural areas. And it, that part seems to be getting worse instead of better from what I'm hearing from a lot of folks.
Well, all you have
one thing I want to say, too, Lester, I'm going to say one more thing. It's not only farmers.
No.
It's a small business people in our small towns.
You bet.
You know, that cannot afford, you know, if they don't have enough employees to have a group plan or anything like this. They are getting hit just as hard as the people in agriculture.
Absolutely.
And that's affecting our small towns. It's affecting everybody. I mean, this health care really has been turned upside down, and it's really frustrating. We got to get this thing fixed. And there's a lot of things. I think the four of us could sit down and we could get it fixed overnight if they'd let us, but that doesn't happen that way.
Well, what we need, Bob, is we need some leadership at the federal level and the state level that looks beyond partisan politics, that actually can sit down in a room like they solved the farm bill and come up with a plan that's bipartisan that people can support. Because what too often what happens with this health care, when it gets politicized, it's become partisan politics and used that way. And I think there probably is some workable solutions out there, but we got to allow that process to happen and come up with those solutions.
Right. All true, Kent. All true.
I don't know either. I mean, this last year I've had tons of health issues, been in the hospital, and they charge you for everything, tissues and gauze and... Gosh sakes, do they have to charge for everything? You know, it just, it you know, it's no wonder that health insurance is high priced. You know, and the other thing is, I think we have to get to the stage where your insurance companies can be competitive and fight for clients.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go on like with no competition. Things go awry when there's no competition. I don't care if you're a machine dealer. I don't care if you're a car dealer. What you are, you got to have competition to keep the price in line. And it's and I've got a lot of friends in the medicine business, in the clinics, and the hospitals, and what have you. And they're still complaining too, but of course they probably complain anyhow. It doesn't matter. But we've got a problem there. That health insurance is one of the real big stickers. Let's go to another subject and. I don't know who wants to take it. Where are we at with this coming year with farm prices and rental prices?
Well, I can tell you one thing. The rents are not going down.
They aren't,
if they are going down, they are going down just a really small percentage. Part of the problem is, you know, the real estate taxes are very high, especially if you have any kind of a new school building or anything like that happening. Taxes are high, and there just isn't people have this land for an income, and they want to keep their percentage up. And as you know, we've been fortunate. There's been some farmers that are being willing to pay this high rent, and some of us are just you know, holding on to what we have and not increasing. But it's going to get tough. It's this is going to be our sixth year of depressed pricing. So a lot of guys working capital.
Doesn't that affect the prices of buying farmland when the commodity prices are so down and you can't make that much?
Farmland's been pretty resilient.
Well, it, you know, I think, you know, Lester, it does over time. And one thing I've noticed with both land rental values and with farmland values is we're seeing the gap widen out a little bit based on quality of land and over in our area, tile drainage. Producers or the buyers or producers in the case of land rent are paying a little more attention to land quality. We've had a lot of wet years. How well is that drained? Maybe the fertility level that's been placed on that farm. So I think there is getting to be a little wider gap out there. We had land in this area. We had some prime farmland here about a month ago. There were three pieces that brought some pretty top dollar, above $8,000 an acre yet, which seems kind of high given where we're at. But then about a week later, we had some land that they had floored at $6,000, and they didn't have a bidder on it. So, but there were some differences, like I talked about, in quality, drainage, that type of stuff. So, and a lot depends too. If you're selling a parcel of land, and you happen a lot of these lands are sales are sold on auction, and like any auction, if you got two or more people interested in the same parcel of land and they got some money behind them, it'll bring more. If you happen to be selling land in an area where maybe none of the neighbors are that interested because they're struggling a little bit and they don't have any outside investors coming in, it might struggle a little. So it's not one size fits all in either case. And I know cases, we happen to be in an area here that had some pretty low yields this past year, especially corn yields. And I know of two or three farmers that have given up some pretty good-sized chunks of rented land for next year just because the rent was too high and they lost a lot of money on it. And now somebody else has come in and rented it, but that doesn't, they obviously... Farmers are kind of looking at the bottom line, especially in areas that have faced a little tougher economic challenges, I think, compared to what they were a couple years ago.
Hey, if I could ask Bob and Kent briefly for some perspective here. We're looking at 2019 planning, and farmers are going to be sitting down with their bankers to talk about operating loans here very soon. And so I want to get both the farmer perspective from Bob and then the banker perspective from Kent on what those conversations are going to be like and how you're going to hammer it out to make sure you can operate another year.
Well, I'm actually done negotiating with my banker. I always start this process in October. We do a lot over the phone, but then we get done and we do the cash flows and all the projections into next year. And, you know, every year it's getting a little tougher. And it's not just the bankers getting tougher, it's the people above them are getting tougher. I mean, the examiners are getting a lot tougher on what they will allow the banks to do. And they're just expecting a lot more from farmers. I mean, we do a tremendous amount of forward contracting into the following years. You know, we used to always just say, here, this is what we got sold. No. Now you have to deliver all the contracts and make sure they have copies of them in our file. I mean, there's just things like this that makes it a lot more time-consuming, but it's also good business. But as we go forward, it's just getting tougher and tougher to get all the paperwork done that they need and to come up with some agreement that we can go forward into farming in 2019. It's, as I talked to our lender, I've been with our lenders since 1986. I went through the 80s with him, and he said he didn't ever want to do another 80s crisis again. Well, he's right in the middle of another crisis that's probably as bad, if not worse, than the 80s. But, you know, he said it's you just got to talk to your banker and constantly just answer any question the banker has, and you'll do just fine. I mean, he'll work with you all that he legally possibly can.
Well, Kent, I want to thank you also because you've had your articles in some of our local papers and very nicely explained. One that says the top four ag issues of 2018, and you wrote those down, and it was a good explanation, really, in the local papers to do that. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, kind of to follow, I think Bob kind of hit a lot of the key points there. You know, I guess the first thing I would say is, everybody tends to treat the, negotiating operating loans like an adversarial relationship between a farm operator and an ag lender, and it's usually not that way at all. Most ag lenders, especially in rural areas, live in a community, whether they're part of a locally owned smaller bank or a large, they're representing a larger financial institution. They live in the community. They go to the same churches, the same school. Yeah. Their kids go to the same schools as the farmers. And for the good of the community and good of the bank, they want to see farmers survive. What keeps these rural banks going or lending institutions is for farmers to be successful. So, right. You know, I think to me, part of the first suggestion I'd make on both cases is try to work together, you know, and try. And the sooner you come in, I think Bob makes a good point. Don't wait until, if your loan doesn't mature till April, don't wait till March 30th to go in. Go in, like Bob said, after harvest. We're now first of the year. Be proactive. Get on your ag lender's calendar. Kind of come in prepared, have things summarized from last year, have an up-to-date balance sheet that has the up-to-date information. And, hey, if you have issues, be honest and upfront. The worst thing you can do is not be honest and break that trust level. You know, hey, the most success I've had when folks have been in trouble is when they're honest and they say, Kent, we got to do something. And I guess the other thing is, we got to be willing to make adjustments. Kind of back to that rented land, if you've rented a farm and paid too much rent 4 years in a row and lost money 4 years in a row, you probably can't keep doing it. Nope. Either that or you got to start raising a more valuable crop on it so you can make it work, you know. And the same thing, you know, I guess, and not to pick on our friends that sell crop inputs, seed, fertilizer, chemicals, but you know, some of the inputs, fertilizer costs are going up again, and, you know, a lot of the top-level seed traits have gotten very expensive. Sometimes I think we got to turn the tables, and if you're a farm operator, you figure out your break even, and you say, this is what I can afford for my inputs. Right. Kind of put your agronomist or your co-op crop consultant on the line and say, hey, I sat down with my banker. This is what we can afford. What's the best program we can put together instead of saying, well, I got to have this much money to do it, even though I'm going to lose $50 an acre, you know. So I think we got to get everybody working as a team here and trying to figure out. Yeah, we got to look at break-even costs and what's realistic and what we can afford and not just keep doing the same old thing over and over again. And it's got a cash flow, and if we haven't cash flowed for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years in a row, we got to make some pretty big changes.